Thanks for downloading this podcast from The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry, and if you're ready, we'll begin. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. And who out there this weekend is going to make a big bowl of popcorn and just veg out on the couch for hours and hours on end watching Game of Thrones?
So many adventures. So much to be thankful for.
Or a whole season of Veep.
Sue, did the president call?
No.
No.
Or Orange is the New Black.
I have been starved out, felt up, teased, stalked, threatened, and called Taylor Swift.
Breaking Bad, you bingers out there, put your hands down. But hey, what if people could download a whole year of The Takeaway? Binge listeners, you rule. I suppose that is something only my mom and dad out in Minnesota would do. But increasingly, it's the way people consume television.
I just caught up on season 3 of Game of Thrones, and I'm really upset. I'm current now. I've got nothing to binge on. I'm like, I have to wait till Sunday.
I only binge, I feel like. all my shows are in chunks of 2 or 3 when I can, and it's definitely House of Cards, Game of Thrones, Orange is the New Black.
I still binge on Scrubs pretty much every day.
Mazel tov.
It's my favorite. It's been over for 5 years, and I still binge watch it.
This hour, a media revolution in binge watching and big data will take you to the Tribeca Film Festival for an amazing conversation with Bo Willimon of House of Cards and David Simon of The Wire. Also, the media revolution in Afghanistan, and what if on a trip to the zoo you could watch animals meeting with their lawyers? Attorneys get into the cage and find clients who aren't the same species but who want the same rights as humans. Finally, we will look at the original formula for pop culture magic, rhythm plus blues, the R&B world of the 1960s, and how it's still with us today. But let's go now to the Tribeca Film Festival right here in New York City, where TV was center stage. Here's Bo Willimon, former campaign worker, now writer and creator of the Netflix hit House of Cards, talking about how online viewing habits have rocked his world.
You have on Netflix viewer sort of scores, like they do stars and they can write little reviews and stuff like that. Now, it's a particular subset of people who take the time to do that, who are invested in doing that. But I find it interesting sometimes when a season comes out to go and look at the 1 and 2 star ratings. And in a way, I find it liberating because you realize that there are certain things, like if you kill a dog in your first 30 seconds, people say, I'm not going to watch this show. I don't like dogs being killed. You go, well, okay, great.
I did not know that.
That person is not meant to watch this show. That doesn't mean I'm going to avoid killing dogs in the future. You sort of realize what you can let go of in a way.
And then there was David Simon of The Wire, who says entertainment and storytelling is not about data.
The only place where I'm attendant to data is in deciding why I want to tell a story. Why is Baltimore a violent city might be a predicate for making a television show about Baltimore, or in this case, The Wire. So how violent is it? What's the nature of the violence? Who's getting killed? Why? That journalism part of it stays with me. That's my original training. Once you're in the realm of actually telling a story and being a storyteller, I have absolutely no interest in what the audience thinks. And it sounds totalitarian to say I'm not writing for the audience, but I've talked to a lot of writers, and you're servicing the story. You're servicing the characters. You bring a world on. You feel responsible to the world. And if you look over your shoulder for a moment and start saying the audience wants more Omar, the audience wants more Stringer, you know, that's why TV was a juvenile medium for most of its existence. It was very much attending to what keeps them here every quarter hour.
We're building something here, Detective. We're building it from scratch. All the pieces matter.
David Simon and Bo Willimon were part of the Tribeca Film Festival's Future of Film series, and I was the radio guy moderator. Together, we media dinosaurs were trying to avoid the flaming asteroids of disruptive viewing patterns in the era of Netflix and all the scary implications of what you can do with big data in the media and entertainment world these days.
This isn't the actual example that Netflix gave me, but I'll just pretend it was. It's like this. They were just looking at the data and they go, all right, well, there's all the people that like Sopranos, right? And for whatever reason, 10% of those people also love 2 and a Half Men, like two totally different types of shows. And no rational mind, no studio exec, no network exec would ever say that's a Venn diagram that should overlap. But the data said it did. So they said, all right, let's push 2 and a Half Men in the suggested for you row to all the Sopranos people and see what happens. And what they found is actually it's closer to 20%. Some people clicked on it, like, oh, I never thought I'd like 2 and a Half Men, but I do. you know, and vice versa. So what is the reason for that? Maybe there is no reason, but there's a correlation that expands people's horizons and that you never would have arrived at without big data or total data.
What do audiences want? What are the two currencies that work with certitude in the entertainment industry? Violence and sex. And as a journalist, I didn't care what the audience's presuppositions were about the issues I was covering when I started to cover them. I wasn't trying to service the political attitude of the viewers. You know, that's why we have MSNBC and Fox right now. So you can watch the news that gratifies what you think you already know about the world. And basically, the entertainment culture is the same way. The entertainment culture is the same way, which is, I like cop shows, I like when they do this. And if you find a show you like, the attitude of the viewer, and the reason that I tune out the audience, is that what the viewer wants is, the stuff you did in the first season that I really liked, do more of that shit. And I really like this guy Omar. Give me more Omar. The audience is like a child. And you're saying, you know, here's your meal. We've got some potatoes. We got some vegetables. And the kid's just going, I want the ice cream.
But there's another way of thinking about it, and that is not doing what has worked, but, and to quote a network person at Netflix, to seek the white spaces where there is no show that could actually supply a set of desires right. that the audience doesn't know it wants. Netflix has done that.
And that might work for the entertainment industry. And if you think Americans aren't yet entertained enough as a people, good. We can get ourselves more entertained with that prescription. Okay, let me knock it down to where the only place that I care about data is, let's go back. Why do people kill each other in America? Why do we kill each other? Why are we the most violent developed nation in the world? Well, 165,000 people were killed in the last full decade, from 2000 to 2010. 165 Americans were homicide victims. Anybody want to take a guess at how many were the victims of serial killers? You know, it's under 1,000. And that's including, you know, a percentage of unsolved that we might attribute based on the known solved. Okay? Serial killers are not our problem. Does anyone want to chart up the number of exhaustive sort of neo-pornographic indulgences that occupy our whole national essence when it comes to discussing violence? We don't want to really discuss why we're killing each other. What is the entertainment culture contributing, if anything? I came out of journalism, and the only stories I'm interested in are what might actually happen in a given city. And that has no currency with audiences. Audiences don't know what they want except what they, you know. We want it to be evil. We want it to be bigger than evil. When, in fact, the problem might be sort of systemic and us.
David Simon of The Wire and the series Tremé and Bo Willimon of the Netflix series House of Cards speaking with me at the Tribeca Film Festival before a live audience. Our topic was all about big data and how online viewing habits are changing the paradigm of television. But it was Bo Willimon, a huge fan of The Wire, who reminded us that binge TV viewing is nothing new. And it was invented by the audience, not some executive at Netflix.
The way I watched The Wire was I binged it. I mean, I wasn't there the first two seasons, and by the time the third came out and all of my friends were telling me it's the most amazing show of all time, I either on demand or through box sets or whatever, I watched three seasons over the course of about a week and a half and agreed with them. So in terms of writing the show, and I can only speak to House of Cards, it has to work both ways. I mean, when we teamed up with Netflix, we knew that releasing all in one day was a possibility, but not an inevitability. We might go week to week.
But you did get a two-season deal, right?
We did get a two-season deal. That really affected the writing, knowing that you had 26 hours and you could lay just a tiny little grace note in the first episode that might not boomerang back until 26 hours later. Mm-hmm. That really liberates you. And taking the pressure off fighting for your life, you know, the way that my friends who work in network television, you know, must when literally you're only as good as your last week's ratings. So, you know, you feel the compulsion to have big cliffhangers or to force and contrive the drama to jack those ratings. I didn't have to deal with any of that.
They're measuring stuff in the quarter of the hour.
Yeah, exactly.
Do they stay with you for the third quarter? Do they stay with you for the fourth quarter?
David, is there anything reassuring about that instead of measuring these quarter hour kind of hamster data, they're measuring bigger sets over the course of an entire season?
Bigger sets mean you get to get your world up, and you get to make a cogent argument for the story you're telling. But if the argument has to be answered with, can you sustain an audience on a Sunday night, I have failed consistently throughout the last 110 hours of television. I can't get you to watch a show when I put it on the air. If it exists in some streaming form or in a box set and word of mouth has some time, people may or may not find their way back. But actually, I don't think what I'm doing quite works for what television still on some level remains. And I think Netflix is breaking the mold. I think, you know, in some ways, HBO was a new window. And when they were just throwing stuff up, stuff, you know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, when they were throwing stuff up against the wall, The Wire could survive for 5 years. I'm not sure The Wire could survive.
That's interesting.
The stakes are higher for HBO now.
The stakes are higher for everyone right now, but suddenly in the era of big data, some people have a voice where they never did before. That's David Simon of The Wire and Bo Willimon of House of Cards speaking at the Tribeca Film Festival. Because companies like Netflix have access to huge streams of data about how viewers watch streamed movies, suddenly you can actually calculate mini-genres of movies and their followers, like Japanese sports movies or post-apocalyptic comedies about friendship or something really crazy, which you can actually calculate, like assassination, bounty hunter, secret society dramas based on books set in Europe for ages 8 to 10. How scary is that?
It's not like you say, all right, let's go make, you know, a short-form documentary about the Middle East that will make kids 8 to 10 happy, right? It's like still the artists, like, say, they sit at a table, they write a script, and they put it in someone's hands, and maybe they... You know, you have executives who say, what category does this, you know, fall into or whatever. More often than not, you know, people don't know what they want. And that means executives as much as anyone until you give it to them. And someone has to give it to them.
Do these data categories empower fans of Arrested Development or Veronica Mars and get something made that never would have been made otherwise?
You know, all those shows that broke ground on HBO in that first generation, nobody was looking at any data. They were just saying, these were guys who worked in TV like Chase, who had followed the rules of TV to the nth degree, who learned all of its tricks, and now they were ready to write something outside of you know, color outside the lines. And I don't know what it was like on his show, but the only way that an HBO network executive would have landed on the set of The Wire in its entire five-year run and tried to look over our shoulder what we were doing is if their plane on the way to Paris crashed in Baltimore. That's the only way. They were not coming to Baltimore for nothing.
The basic thing is there's no data for the new.
Right.
Because it's new, there's no statistics for it. There's nothing. You can't.
But when they're armed with that stuff, they produce, as you said, derivative second, like in the pocket. Like there is a formula now for the... He's an anti-hero. He's on the outsides of society. He's doing wrong, but he has a family. But, you know, maybe he talks to a shrink. Maybe he doesn't talk to a shrink. But he's torn up about it. He's got this issue. You know, it's like they just keep watching The Sopranos over and over. It's like they think, catch that fire in that bottle. And, you know, nobody...
What about Sopranos with vampires?
What?
Yeah.
And he's a vampire.
Yeah, and he's a vampire.
You know, and he's got, you know... And like, there's just these... It's like cloning. It becomes weaker with every generation. The idea that this data is becoming... its own authority on the you know, this is what we should make, and scares the hell out of me.
David Simon of The Wire and Bo Willimon of House of Cards speaking with me at the Tribeca Film Festival. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Be empowered. There's more this hour for you to binge on. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International, in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
So imagine what it takes to be a TV hit in a place like Afghanistan. On one level, a nation emerging from chaos could probably use some escapist entertainment. The news of three dead American hospital workers this week killed by an Afghan security guard is a sign of how dangerous Afghanistan remains, even as votes are counted in the recent national elections. But entrepreneurs like Saad Mohseni aren't waiting and watching the headlines to decide whether to invest in Afghanistan's future. Mohseni is chairman and chief executive of the Mobi Group, which has found success inside Afghanistan and in the region. Mobi has leveraged its foothold in Kabul and used the Wild West chaos of Afghanistan to create an unregulated media brand that has caught the attention of TV viewers in Iran, tired of clergy-restricted television, looking for fresh voices and stories online and on the air. Saad Mohseni says with all the difficulties in Afghanistan right now, this just might be a golden age for media.
you know, we have a series of transitions to go through. The political transition probably is going to be the single most important one, followed by the military transition as the American forces draw down completely and the Afghans take over. And then we have the economic transition in terms of, you know, with the U.S. and our international allies no longer funding the Afghan economy. How does Afghanistan stand on its own two feet? So we have these transitions. This is the first one, but it's going to be the single most important one. It's going to shape the way the country is going to look like in the next 5 years.
I mean, all those questions relate to your company. Can Moby Group stand on its own two feet without U.S. funding or USAID or the military security questions being answered by U.S. and NATO forces?
Well, we've already transitioned in the early years, for example, a very large chunk of the advertising money was related to international funding, donor funding. For example, the Ministry of Health, its campaigns were indirectly funded by the international community. But the numbers are less and less. I mean, we're talking about like 20% now. That's somehow the international community is responsible for. The general economy has picked up to the point that, you know, the likes of Coke and Nestle and, you know, all these multinationals, the telecommunications companies, the banks, they're heavy advertisers. But we cannot also ignore the fact that the general economy has been bolstered by the international presence in the country. So we have to be very careful, you know, not to assume that the economy is going to be okay. So we have some challenges ahead.
In 2013, there was certainly a lot of optimism. You spoke about the plans to even expand your media empire into Iran. Mm. A year later, when we're really looking at the votes being counted and the political transition underway in Afghanistan, is it a little bit scarier in 2014 than the dreams that one could dare to dream in 2013?
Well, we already have a channel going into Iran. We're in seven countries now, and Afghanistan represents you know, a shrinking chunk of that pie as a business expands regionally. But, you know, we're investing millions in Afghanistan. Next year, we're building a very large media center just because we've grown the business so quickly. So, yes, we do have expansion plans. The question is, how much do you expand by? Now, the growth year on year is going to slow. But nonetheless, Afghanistan, its economy will continue to grow because we've come off such a low base in 2001.
Do you sense a hunger on the part of Afghans to really just put the politics and the military issues aside and use Moby Group's offerings and other entrepreneurs as an escape? Or do they view your success mindful of the politics? In other words, people are basically entering into the future with their eyes open. They're not trying to get away from it all.
You know, I grew up in Australia, and one of the things about Australians is that they're completely, you know, apathetic when it comes to politics.
Right.
They never take their politicians seriously. They ridicule them. In Afghanistan, so in Australia, a lot of people follow politics. They do it. It's a hobby of sorts. They had to make voting compulsory in Australia because otherwise no one would vote. But in a place like Afghanistan, you need to understand what's going on because it impacts your life. Even on a day-to-day basis, you need to find out if there was an attack, because your kids are going to school, your wife works in a different part of the city. But also, Afghans want the basics. They want to be entertained. They want to visit their friends. They want to have fun. They want to play sports. And I gave a talk yesterday. I talked about the changes we've seen. Today, 6 million Afghans have access to the internet from zero 3 years ago. A population of 30 million people. Now, that's set to grow double or triple in the next few years, of which 60% of the internet-using population use their mobile devices to access the internet. So we're leapfrogging what you went through in terms of infrastructure and cable to the curb and all of that. People are just accessing YouTube and Facebook and Twitter using a mobile device. So the population is changing very, very quickly.
Do those people have faith in the possible winners in this leadership election? They're doctors. They're interchangeable from what I can see and very much associated with the elites of the past. But nevertheless, they're going to be running things.
Yes. I mean, if you look at the candidates, what's impressive about these people is that they're probably better educated than all the other leaders in the region. So it's quite an extraordinary example of very qualified people. But what's also interesting about the elections was that it wasn't just a rejection of the Taliban, because people came out and voted when they were told not to, but it was also a rejection of some of the candidates who were more fundamentalists. They basically did very badly.
How does the business success that you've enjoyed and other commercial successes in Afghanistan stack up against the heroin trade and the opium trade, which still thrives throughout this period of transition?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anyone really tackled the issue of drugs in the country. It was an issue that people said it was too hard. Let's kick this can down the road. I mean, you would see U.S. soldiers going into battle with their guns and everything, going past poppy fields. I mean, no one made an effort to destroy those fields. So it was a secondary problem. But I think at some stage we have to get a lot more serious with drugs. And we may have to, you know, have some radical ideas in terms of potentially legalizing some exports of whether it's marijuana or opiates. And that in itself could help Afghanistan.
Well, the best of luck.
Thank you.
Saad Mohseni is the chairman and chief executive of Mobi Group, Afghanistan's leading media company.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
Dad, are any of these movies good?
Worst episode ever.
I see a lot of films. I love all of them.
Your job is to rate movies on a scale from good to excellent.
Hated it.
On Friday, we love to spend time with our favorite movie bingers, binge viewers. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, co-host of the Movie Date podcast with Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway and co-host of the Movie Date podcast. Kristen and Rafer, welcome.
Hi, John. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday, indeed. And we begin with the movie Brick Mansions, which is a very interesting and somber action movie for a lot of reasons. Let's hear a clip.
I spent my entire career trying to take down Tremaine, but he never leaves brick mansions and there's checkpoints everywhere.
You know the routes around them.
Yeah, but then what? You have no intel inside? No eyes?
We have your eyes. Lino Dupree, French Caribbean expat, spent most of his adult life in brick mansions. Knows it like the back of his hand.
What's he locked up for anyway?
Killed a cop.
The late Paul Walker speaking there. We always ask the question, is there life for Paul Walker after Fast and Furious? This movie proves perhaps that there is, but there's no Paul Walker. Rafer, what do you think of it?
Well, this is a remake of District B-13, the French film from Luc Besson. Besson did not direct this one. It takes place in a dystopian Detroit, a walled-off ghetto in Detroit. Paul Walker plays an undercover cop. He's hunting a kingpin named Tremaine, played by RZA, the rapper.
Right, from Wu-Tang Clan.
Yes. It's pretty dopey stuff, but the big attraction here is the parkour stunts. David Bell, one of the stars, is one of the founders and inventors of parkour, which is that kind of urban gymnastics form. You've seen in other movies.
Which attracted RZA to this movie. He's a big parkour fan.
Yeah, he's a big martial arts fan and action fan. So I would say what breakdancing was to break and parkour is to Brick Mansions. It's the whole reason you would go see this film. And it's pretty eye-popping. There's a lot of great stunt work in it, that's for sure.
That's the formula, but does it work for Kristen Meinzer?
You know, I have to actually totally agree with Rafer. The parkour is unbelievable. It looks like flying. The first opening chase sequence is so mind-blowing. You think they're using special effects to make all of this happen. You're jumping out of a building. You're landing by doing flips. And it's so beautiful to watch. It's like a cross between dancing and acrobatics and killing. I do have to say the plot is ridiculous. There is, in addition to trying to take down this kingpin, there's also a neutron bomb. There's a henchman who only wears lingerie. There's a lot of ridiculous stuff in this. And yet, I just, for the martial arts alone, I'd say it's totally worth it. And it is great to see Paul Walker.
Choreographic realism. Maybe a new genre.
Yes, I mean, it could be.
Big data will calculate whether that will work or not. The other movie you're looking at is The Other Woman.
That's not the point. I don't do married guys. I don't need to wreck someone's home for a date.
It's not always a wreck. Stan and I were married when we met. We weren't happy.
You wrecked two marriages.
First of all, one of them was mine, so that doesn't count.
I don't think that's how it works.
little sociology here, a little The View, Cameron Diaz, Nicki Minaj. Kristen, what do you think?
Well, as the title says, this is the other woman. You have a woman who finds out her husband is cheating on her with another woman, and then they find out that he's cheating with yet another woman and more women. The women team up, try to take him down. It's kind of trying to be a 9-to-5 sort of thing. Unfortunately, it doesn't have the punch, the snap. It's not as tight as 9-to-5. I wish it would have been, because I really love a great female ensemble comedy.
Trailer better than the movie, Rafer?
Yeah, most of the funny parts are in the trailer. Nicki Minaj, who plays Cameron Diaz's secretary, is actually quite funny. She gets probably some of the best lines in the film, actually.
Well, she's got a future. What's on the Movie Date podcast this week?
This week we have a listener who wants Rafer and I to help her prepare for an international vacation she's taking with some of her girlfriends. And we're going to prescribe some movies to help prepare her for that big journey.
Well, binge listen to the Movie Date podcast by going to thetakeaway.org, or you can subscribe at moviedatepodcast.org. Rafer and Kristen, have a great weekend.
You
Thanks
too, John.
So much, John.
Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, co-host of the Movie Date podcast with producer Kristen Meinzer.
It's so beautiful to watch. It's like a cross between dancing and acrobatics and killing.
Staying with the entertainment world, we want to focus on a scandal in Hollywood surrounding a man known as a leader in bringing diversity to Hollywood. Here's actor Ian McKellen speaking about director Bryan Singer.
When Bryan Singer asked me to get involved, I didn't know the X-Men comics, and was a little bit bewildered as to how I could fit in. And he said to me, being a mutant, which is what all the X-Men are, and the difficulties that they face in a society that doesn't like them because they're different, is something that an openly gay person might want to be involved with. And he, Marvel indeed pointed out that the demographic for their popularity is amongst young blacks, young gays, and young Jews.
That's Ian McKellen on X-Men director Bryan Singer speaking earlier this year. But today, Singer is defending himself from the charge that he is at the center of an out-of-control Hollywood culture that once preyed on young men. Bryan Singer stands accused of rape and sexual assault by a 31-year-old man who says Singer preyed on him during wild parties in the 1990s that promised teenage boys acting work in exchange for sex. Singer calls the charges outrageous, vicious, and completely false. Sharon Waxman is editor-in-chief at the entertainment new media venture The Wrap, which covers Hollywood. Welcome, Sharon.
Hi, John.
So this has already disrupted the launch of one of the biggest movies of the summer, wouldn't you say?
Well, yeah. I mean, this lawsuit was obviously timed to get maximum attention by coming a month before the big X-Men movie is about to come out. So it's not a coincidence.
What are the allegations, and how have they, really been the buzz in Hollywood and the entertainment industry for the last week?
Yeah, I think these allegations have everybody on edge, and it's because they're not just against Bryan Singer. That was just the first volley. There are three other executives who've already been named by the same accuser and his lawyer, and they're also prominent members of either the film. One of them is a film executive, another television executive, and an off-Broadway producer, all of whom, I should add, have also strongly denied the allegations. They're very similar, the allegations against Bryan Singer being part of these parties where they would lure in young men and end up raping them. And this would go on over and over. It's a very difficult kind of case because, first of all, it happened 15 years ago, number one. Number two, these are not criminal charges. They're lawsuits. They're civil charges. If they're accurate, then they're very, very serious, and they absolutely need to be taken seriously. When I say that the industry is on edge, it's because looming in the background is this threat by the lawyer to name even more names of prominent people in the industry.
At the very least, does this constitute a reveal of a subculture that's perhaps well known in Hollywood that hasn't been focused on even by journalists?
I'm going to say yes to that. It's been kind of amazing the reaction that I've seen and heard in the past week, which has pretty much been along. And I say both, if you read the comments on our stories, there's a lot of them and phone calls that I've gotten, and they're saying things like, everybody knew this kind of thing was going on. Everybody knew that there were young men, wild parties, kind of thing. And then, and also a sense that these parties stepped over the line, that they were, there was something not right about them.
How difficult has it been to tread as the rap has, you know, covered these allegations? I mean, even though people say this was well known, you've probably got people saying, if you mention my name, the lawyers come out.
Well, for sure, we're not going to dabble in naming names in something that could potentially ruin people's reputations. There is a very powerful and active gay community in Hollywood. There's long been, serious and comic serious allegations of a gay mafia in Hollywood. So this sort of raises the specter of that, of an omerta of a certain kind. Among a group of powerful people. But, you know, I've gotten calls from lawyers saying, what do you know? Who do you know who else is going to be named? I have calls from publicists. People are very much worried that whether or not there's any truth to the allegations, that they may be named anyway.
Founder and editor-in-chief of The Wrap, Sharon Waxman, on the Bryan Singer scandal in Hollywood. Thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
So lawyers have the reputation of being ruthless predators, sometimes at least. I once hired an attorney who had a tank full of piranha in his office. I'm not kidding. He wanted that animal metaphor to reassure me about his passion for winning in court. It mostly made me nervous. He was a good lawyer. But what about the animals themselves? I mean, what if a piranha hired a lawyer and went to court to get humans to stop polluting their river homes? Well, that is the logic behind a court battle brewing in New York State. Animals are not people. But can they be clients represented by people lawyers? Stephen Wise is president of the Non-Human Rights Project and joins me now. Stephen Wise, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So describe these clients that you are representing in a case here in New York.
Well, the Non-Human Rights Project is actually representing four chimpanzees in three cases across the state of New York. One is in Niagara Falls, one is in Gloversville in the central part of New York, and two are being held captive in Stony Brook on Long Island.
And the petition that these chimps are ostensibly bringing is they want their captors to release them?
Yes, we're bringing what are called common law writs of habeas corpus. And we're saying that they ought to be legal persons. That is, they ought to have the right to have the capacity for some rights, and that the right we're asking the courts to recognize is their fundamental right to bodily liberty that's protected by a writ of habeas corpus, and we want them released to sanctuaries.
Now, what if a judge asks you, Counselor Wise, is there any evidence that your clients are actually interested in suing or even know what a courtroom is?
They may not know what a courtroom is, but they certainly are interested in getting out of the captive situations that they are in. One thing we did was file affidavits from nine of the most competent and experienced ape researchers, both in the wild and captivity from around the world, Japan, Germany, Scotland, England, the U.S., showing what kind of extraordinarily intelligent and cognitively complex and autonomous beings they are. And any being who is like them, who is as autonomous as they are, will not want to be kept in a cage.
Why would you draw the line at intelligence? I mean, what if a judge says to you, why does intelligence qualify people to have rights or qualify animals to have rights? Why draw the line at chimpanzees? Aren't dogs and cats and fish and snails eligible for this?
Well, we're saying that the most important characteristic for our purposes is autonomy, that chimpanzees are autonomous because autonomy is what is protected by writs of habeas corpus, and that our chimpanzees have them. And perhaps in other cases we'll file suit on behalf of other beings, but all we're talking about in these cases are the autonomy that chimpanzees have.
What evidence do you have that judges and the courts are going to take this seriously?
Well, we know they're taking it seriously. Whether we're going to win is another story, or at least whether we're going to win the early cases. We think that eventually we are going to win. We are basing our arguments on law that judges use every single day, the law that they're educated in, that they themselves say they value. We're basing our cases on fundamental legal principles of liberty and equality, the same that allowed a diverse group of humans, now all of us humans, to have rights at one time or another.
Let's talk about the facts in this case. I mean, the main client here is Tommy, right?
We have four of them. One is Tommy, one is Kiko in Niagara Falls, and two of them are Hercules and Leo at Stony Brook.
What are the facts in the Tommy case that make this a compelling argument?
Well, I think the main fact, as far as habeas corpus is concerned, is that when I went and saw Tommy, he was sitting in a small cage by himself. And chimpanzees, for one thing, are extraordinarily social beings. They should never live alone, ever. It's like putting them in solitary confinement. And he's not only is he by himself, but he's in a cage. I have been with chimpanzees in the wild in Uganda, and I know how many miles a day they move around. And to keep a chimpanzee imprisoned in a cage is simply morally wrong, and it ought to be, and we hope it is going to be, legally wrong.
What do you think this case hinges on? Because if a judge rules that chimpanzees have to be released because they're intelligent, autonomous beings, it could affect every zoo in the United States. It could affect pets. I mean, it could certainly open the doors for a lot of new clients for lawyers.
Well, the cases would strictly affect only chimpanzees who are in the state of New York, and we think we have all four of them covered. We think right now there are only four left. When we began thinking of suing, there were seven, and three of them have died in the last year, which is another reason why we need to get them out of the places where they are. Three of the seven chimpanzees who were alive in March of 2013 or in May of 2014 are dead.
What's the principle here of the non-human rights project, Stephen Wise, and what is the principle that you hope to really establish in law as a result of this case?
Well, we're trying to persuade the courts that the wall kind of that has existed so long between humans and non-humans, by which all human beings are legal persons who have the capacity for rights, and all non-human animals are legal things who don't have the capacity for any rights at all, is an arbitrary wall, and that there are certain characteristics that at least some non-humans have that should entitle them to be on the other side of that wall, and they should also be legal persons with the capacity to have certain kinds of fundamental rights like bodily liberty.
Finally, wouldn't it be better for you to use your legal expertise to go to Rikers Island and maybe get some of the people who've been sitting there for years awaiting trial sprung from their confinement? They're humans.
They are humans, and the ones who deserve to be sprung, I am happy to say, have many, many lawyers who are working on their behalf. The non-human animals of the world only have the Non-Human Rights Project.
Stephen Wise, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Stephen Wise is a lawyer and president of the Non-Human Rights Project, representing chimpanzees in the state of New York. You know, come to think of it, maybe Hollywood is ahead of us all on this animal thing. If a chimpanzee was watching TV, the networks, of course, would be thrilled to count primates in the ratings. Perhaps primatologists could answer the question, do monkeys binge watch TV? We already know the answer for humans, right? You know, Homo sapiens is a Netflix binger.
Hi, I'm Ayo, calling from Austin, and yes, I absolutely think my TV watching is different now. I don't own a TV, but I'm always up to date on all my shows, and House of Cards is my favorite show to binge watch.
And a human from Ithaca, New York says definitely watching three episodes back-to-back is much better than waiting for the same content over 3 weeks, but the waiting time between seasons hurts more now. Tell us your television habits. We're taking data, 877-8-MY-TAKE. Follow us on Twitter, at The Takeaway. This is The Takeaway. So finally this hour, there is something goofily magical about a popular song, right? Why this was a hit is one of those unanswerable questions. I mean, who could predict that something like this would make it? Like the TV shows that make it or don't, there is no algorithm that can reliably calculate how and why Hang On Sloopy was one of the top songs of 1964, 50 years ago. If there is an algorithm for making hits, though, it lived once upon a time in the troubled heart of music producer Burt Burns, who gave the world Brown Eyed Girl. Under the Boardwalk and Take Another Little Piece of My Heart, a song which in a few minutes you will never hear in the same way again. It's the story of music producer and writer Joel Selvin's new book, Here Comes the Night, The Dark Soul of Burt Burns and the Dirty Business of Rhythm and Blues. Rhythm plus blues equals gold. And that was perhaps the first formula of pop music hits, and Burt Burns was right in the middle of it all.
Dead center, he was a gear that was pushed up against all the other gears in New York for 7 years, starting in 1960. Lieber and Stoller, Ahmet Erdogan and Jerry Wexler, Burt Bacharach, Phil Spector, Goffin and King, all of them had something to do with Burns. He sat in the center of them, and in many ways he made some of the best records any of those guys did.
Did Burt Burns want to be a songwriter, a performer? Did he love being a producer? He started his own record label, Bang Records.
Well, Burt Burns had rheumatic fever as a 14-year-old, and he was told that he wouldn't live to be 21. He dropped out of school and really didn't do anything with his life for a long time and didn't get into the record business until he was 30 years old. I think his show business ambitions were always there. He had sort of an interest in doing a little comedy, doing some mambo concerts, starting a record label in 1950 for a minute. But nothing came of that until 1960, when he landed a $50 a week job at Robert Mellon Music as a song plugger. And there he started writing songs. In 1961, he had his first chart record, the Jarmels' A Little Bit of Soap.
A little bit of soap will wash away your lipstick on my face. But a little bit of soap will never, 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 ever erase the pain.
And in 1962, he started producing records for Atlantic Records with Solomon Burke, whose records with Burns made him one of the biggest stars of rhythm and blues and saved Atlantic Records from a very dire financial condition.
I interviewed Solomon Burke.
Magnificent man.
Oh, magnificent man, the greatest guy. And, you know, it just shows how ignorant I am. He was always talking about and thanking Burt. And I didn't know who the heck he was talking about. And the picture really wasn't filled out until I read this book.
Well, Solomon has some resentments over the songwriting credits on Everybody Needs Somebody to Love, which is shared equally between Solomon Burke, Burt Burns, and Jerry Wexler. We're not sure that either Wexler or Burns had much to do with the song's composition, and if you listen to it, it reads exactly like a Solomon Burke sermon.
Sometimes you get what you want, and you lose what you have. And there's a song I sing, and I believe if everybody was to sing the song, you'd save the whole world. Listen to me.
You know, Solomon Burke's birth was foretold, and he was born 12 years later. There was already a church founded for him by his grandmother, and there was a lot of excitement around his birth. And at age 7, he was preaching. By the age of 9, he was traveling the country, taking his message out in the world. He made gospel records in the mid-50s and then dropped out after he wasn't being paid fairly and went into the undertaking business. Only came back into the record business because Wexler approached him and asked him to record for Atlantic. Amazing man.
Absolutely amazing. Tell me about Burt Burns' hits and what he saw in rock and roll, and particularly in even some of the Afro-Cuban success that he had in the mambo music that other people didn't see.
The important thing about Burns' music that distinguished it was this mambo influence. A lot of the New York songwriters and record producers of the era incorporated Latin rhythms. But Burns was strictly an Afro-Cuban guy, and the mambo is quite a bit different than the Brazilian kind of Latin music. It's a much more sinful, sensual, raunchy kind of rhythm and fiery stuff at the time. You look at a song like Twist and Shout, which Burns originally recorded with the Isley Brothers, and it's just taken off of the same chord progression that La Bamba and Guantanamera are based on.
Guantanamera.
loved that chord progression. He used it very, very effectively throughout his career.
A Latin tune. Man, you're opening my eyes, bud. What about Peace of My Heart?
That's so interesting. He wrote that song with Jerry Ragavoy. It was very close to the end of his life, and the physical symptoms of his heart's deterioration were getting much more prominent, and he knew the end was near. All he had was one line: take it. Take another little piece of my heart. I just have a hard time getting my head around a guy whose heart is failing. It's probably the single most dominant fact of his life, writing a song around that line, take another little piece of my heart. You know you got it
if it makes you feel good. So powerful. You know, the pictures in this book are just too much. I mean, it's really going into a time machine. I mean, there's one shot here of Burns and Neil Diamond and a couple other folks I'm less familiar with, and everybody with a smile on their face. You describe Here Comes the Night, the dark soul of Burt Burns. Boy, a lot of the pictures in here, he just seems to be on top of the world.
He was a Prince of Broadway.
What's the dark soul part?
Well, there's an ambiguity to that term intended. One, I'm referring to the kind of music that he made, which is, you know, soul music, and it's very dark. Burns's music pushes his singers to the edge of despair. There's an urgency, there's a hysteria to his music. It just lays in every song. So that sense, dark soul. The other is, of course, a reference to his doomed heart and the darkness that he lived under because of that.
He did not survive the R&B era. What would he think about our time right now?
Well, you know, Burt Burns was so much a man of his times, formed in the 40s and 50s and coming to age in the 60s and having such a great role, big part in opening up the musical culture. But Burns' songs, they're trapped in his pathology, and they just seem so intense and urgent and desperate. And I sensed out of those records somebody who was writing about himself, even though he didn't think that that was what he was doing.
Well, it's been great hanging out, Joel.
John, what a pleasure.
Joel Selvin's new book is Here Comes the Night, the Dark Soul of Burt Burns and the Dirty Business of Rhythm and Blues. Learn something new today. Peace of My Heart, a song about a failing heart, literally. The heart of Burt Burns, Prince of Broadway, a half century ago. I'll take that into the weekend. What are you going to take into the weekend? Sure to binge watch for us. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or find us at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.